This is KSQD Santa Cruz. From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
The artist Eric Fischel is my guest. His influential work has been shown in museums throughout the world. He is a painter, sculptor, printmaker, and educator, and he's an author. His memoir is called Bad Boy, My Life on and Off the Canvas. Eric Fischel, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me. I feel honored.
Thank you. There was an acting teacher and actor named Jeff Corey. And he, on the first day, he asked his class to write down a list of all the things they could do if they didn't make it as an actor. And after they had finished, he said, if you wrote anything down, you can leave.
Bravo.
And I was thinking of that when I heard in your book, you said, painters don't choose to be painters. They just choose to be better painters.
Yeah, I learned that as a student, because I was a student at a time when painting was literally declared dead, officially declared dead. And so the school I went to, which was really focused on the most advanced kind of thinking, the most advanced kind of approaches to creativity, did everything they could to discourage painters and try to get them to go into new media, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, as a young student, I tried, but I kept coming back to painting and realized within that time that I came back for a reason. It was something that was part of a DNA, or, you know, it was something that was so fundamental for the way I process information, the way I process experience, that it was pointless to try to take it away from me. So
there was nothing for you but to paint.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And then, as I said, you know, what you try to do is get better at it.
Yeah. You didn't exactly sit down to write your autobiography.
That's true. I didn't sit down, first of all. And secondly, it was a book that, when it did start to move into a book idea, was not even a book about me. I played tennis with a guy, Michael Stone, who was had been a journalist for New York Magazine and some other publications, and he had done an article for New York Magazine on Julian Schnabel back in the 80s. And that was the extent of his understanding of the sort of contemporary art world. But he was curious about it. And we played tennis together. And so before and after, during changeovers, sitting around resting, he would ask me questions. This was taking place over a, you know, year and a half, 2 years. And he became particularly focused on this idea that there are historically these places like art schools that all of a sudden become hot. And he was wondering about that. And he got this idea that it'd be interesting to write about Cal Arts, the early years, which is when I was there. So I introduced him to artists that I knew that were close by that I'd gone to school with and stuff, so that he could start interviewing them, and which he did. And then we'd get together to play tennis, and he'd say, oh, I just had a great conversation with David Sally. And yeah, wonderful. But what is appropriation? And then I would sort of try to explain my understanding of appropriation, which was very much a part of the sort of philosophical, you know, aesthetics of the time. And he'd say that, you know, I went and talked to Ross, and what is, and he, you know, simulacra, what is, but, you know, and you just go through these things. So over a period of time, it became clear that I was the intermediary. I was the one that was translating this, you know, contemporary art world to him through my eyes. And then his book agent came to him and said, no one's going to do a book where there's more than one voice, you know, where there's too many voices. You should try to focus it on one voice. And so he came back to me and he says, you want to write a book about art? I was like, what? And his idea was almost like a handbook, because what he enjoyed in the conversations with me is I would talk about my process or something. And he found that very engaging. And he thought, wouldn't that be great to do like a handbook on artistic process? And as somebody who believes in you know, art education, of trying to expand an audience's awareness of the artistic and creative process, I thought, yeah, that's not a bad idea. And then when we got a publisher involved in it, they said they wanted it to be more of a memoir, that they liked the process part of it, but they wanted it interwoven with a memoir that focused on this particularly, you know, sort of folklorish time that I came out, which was the 80s, and, you know, and thought that would be an exciting thing. So I began to do that. And this was, so now it turned into a memoir, but Michael already had over 2 years of conversations. And after a while we were taping them and, or he's handwriting things, et cetera. So he had a lot to go on. And so he took the first stab at putting it into a memoir form. And he handed it to me when it was done, and, you know, said he was trying very hard to capture my voice. And so I handed it to my wife, because I actually don't like to listen to myself, and I don't like to read things that I've written, you know, it's, I always feel like, oh boy, did I blow that one. So, so I handed it to her, and she's reading it across the table from me and just going, oh God, oh Jesus, oh, I can't believe, you know. And I'm like, what? What's, well, you, she says, I hate this guy. And I went, you hate Michael? And he goes, no, I hate you. I said, what? Give me that thing. And I started to read it. And Michael had come out of, you know, sort of street journalism, you know, New York tough guy kind of thing. And so he kind of gave me that voice. I was a tough guy who was going through this thing in some way that is just not me. But, you know, what he had done was he'd actually created the bones and the arc of the story. And so it was easy to kind of shift it over into the way I might tone it, you know.
But when you say you don't like to read things you've written or hear yourself talk, do you like looking at your paintings?
I like, I mean, I guess it's all the same in the sense that what I see first is everything that's wrong. But I'm not as casual a painter as I am a speaker, right? A conversationalist.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a storyteller no matter what, but in terms of my relationship to just talking, if I don't have to see it in print, if I don't have to hear it again, I'm okay with that, you know, whereas with the painting, I look at it and I see what I blew or what I maybe could have done better and stuff. But
do you feel the urge right then at a museum to pick up a brush and just, I'm just going to fix this?
No, because the way I paint is not trained in a kind of hyper skilled way, so that if I go back into a painting, the painting could change, you know. So, you know, if I started blowing the figure that I was trying to fix, that figure gets painted out as a solution.
Yeah, you talked about that in your book, that the painting goes through several phases. In fact, you told an interesting story about some people who had somehow forged your work. There was art forgeries of preliminary sketches of paintings for which there were no preliminary sketches.
Yeah. Yeah, that was quite an experience for me, because I was visiting. I was brought to Geneva to give a talk to clients of Sotheby's. And when I arrived, I was taken up to the director's office, and he was, as a way of sort of enthusiastically welcoming me, he was flattering me with this, like, oh, we've got this fantastic work of yours at auction in London. And which is not the thing an artist really wants to hear, that their work is at auction. But anyway, he pulls it out and he's showing it to me, and I'm looking at this thing and it looks exactly like something I had done, but I didn't remember doing it. And so my first reactions were really, you know, awkward and feeling like I'm losing my mind. I can't believe I can't remember this, et cetera. And then the longer I stared at it, I realized, of course, I didn't make this. I've never did a preliminary sketch of anything that I've done that had all the details in, of the finished piece in it. And this had everything in it. And so it would, you know, it just wasn't mine. And yeah.
So on the one hand, it's like, I'm being ripped off and this is terrible. But on the other hand, it must be sort of flattering. I mean, they could have made forgeries of Van Gogh or Rembrandt, yeah, but they chose Eric Fischel.
Yeah, no, definitely mixed feelings. But there was a third thing. It was like, I'm being ripped off. That's terrible. I'm flattered. That's good. And oh,
beep,
I'm imitatable.
The imitable Eric Fischel.
Yeah, the ever imitable.
You were talking about being at CalArts and you said a minute ago that they were trying to steer you toward new media or other media. What were the kinds of things that they were considering that were new and different that would replace painting?
Well, at the time, this was 1970, the video had become a thing. Then the port-a-pack, the easily handled kind of media package that was. So that was one of the things they were pushing. There was performance had become another genre in the arts, installation, things that were sort of, you know, moving away from traditional sense of object making, traditional sense of gallery presentation. Conceptual art was raging at the time, which was a de-objectification of everything. So it's, you know, it's about, you know, a mind over matter. And yeah, you know, just being able to represent a thought without actually making it and stuff like that. So all those things were what they considered avant-garde. And so they were, of course, trying to push their students into those areas. And you know, and most of the people I went to school with at that time were trying those different things, too. I mean, why not? But
mm-hmm. Yeah, that reminds me of a question that I wanted to ask you when I was reading your book. You talk a bit in your book about Jeff Koons, and not particularly favorably. And for my listeners, Jeff Koons does a lot of work that is, I guess he's most famous for balloon animals that are cast in shiny chrome and blown up big, or little gift shop trinkets that have been blown up to larger than life size, or a gigantic puppy made of flowers that's several stories high. And he doesn't actually make his work. He commissions it by craftsmen. I think a lot of lay people might look at that work and find it pleasurable, not necessarily understand that he didn't actually make it. I think that might throw some people off. But at the same time, people might look at work by, say, Jackson Pollock, and that people would say, "Oh, I could have done that when I was five, because it doesn't appear to be anything but splashed paint." Mm-hmm. So I want to know why you don't value what Jeff Koons is doing, but would, or maybe you don't value what Jackson Pollock did.
Well, it's a, I think they're two different things. One is Jackson Pollock was part of a history leading up to me, right? So in order to be a responsible artist, I have to consider it. I have to figure out, can I grow? Can I work through? Can I get past a lot of the work that was done in the past, right? Part of the history of artists has artists in it that they close something off. You can no longer do that. Pollock is one of those. He took painting to an extreme that you would always fall short of and be under his influence because of that, right? Which is, was not my ambition. But then there are other artists that leave a door open, you know, so that you can sort of absorb what they've done and carry that into your own time, your own language, your own space. So that's a very different thing. It's not like I'm putting, you know, Pollock on one scale and Koons on the other, and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
They're two different relationships to history and to the present and to moving forward.
And to your painting.
But and the thing about the irony is, first of all, that I went to Cal Arts, which was funded by and founded by Walt Disney. And we had a very sort of negative idea of who Disney was. I have over the years come to reassess that, because I think he was an extraordinary genius. But I, at the time, it just seemed like he was somebody that was rounding off the edges of every life experience. And it was not something that I could deal with or care about. But he was somebody that had brought high level execution creativity to a mass public. And that's where Jeff Koons comes in, because Jeff Koons is standing on the shoulders of Disney and Warhol's in there somewhere as well. But I think Warhol's a far more complex and compelling artist than Koons is. But Koons is brilliant at doing a lot of what Disney did and doing it in a kind of contemporary way, so it looks fresh. And but it's not something that I gravitate towards or can use. So, you know, he just is a noise that's out there.
Now, your work is not abstract anymore, but you did begin with abstraction, right? How did you evolve from abstraction, and to what degree does abstraction figure in your practice now?
Yeah, the abstract expressionists really believed that, you know, that composition, that the abstract nature of composition was really the bones of a painting. And part of modernism was about stripping everything down to the bone. So that's where you get into the purity of the abstraction movement. So I love abstract painting. I just realized after, you know, a few years in school and a few years out of school that I actually wasn't very good at it. and I didn't actually have that kind of mind, that I was a storyteller, that I was somebody that, you know, was reacting not so much to a color of a shape, but to a person bending over. You know, if I made an abstract shape out of a person bending over, I wouldn't know what to do with it. But if I just use a person bending over, I could weave a whole moment around why that person was bending over. And so I obviously moved into figuration and to narrative, but underneath it is all the training I had for how to make a rectangle be active, how to organize shapes and colors in a way that feels alive and on some level you're not even particularly aware of. You just are looking at a dramatic moment.
Now, when you begin a painting, often you said that you don't know what the final painting will look like.
Right.
Or even what the content will be.
Mm. Yeah. I'm looking for content in the work. I used to start out with very early on, I started taking photographs, snapshots of people, candid snapshots, so they didn't know they were being photographed. And I did that because two reasons. One is I was staring at them, not knowing why I was staring at them. And the other was that if I went up to them and asked them if I could take their picture and could they repeat what they just did,
Yeah, right. They
wouldn't be able to do it, right? They'd be self-conscious. They wouldn't even have been aware of what they were doing, you know, et cetera. And so I would take photographs and then I would start to construct paintings and from taking, again, that person doing whatever it was that made me stare at them and putting them onto a blank canvas or a somewhat arbitrary space. I would say, what would this be like if they were in the kitchen doing this? Would that be different than if they were in the garage? You know? And so I would I'd put them into a space and either that space would hold them or it was the wrong space, and then I'd have to change the space. But so the process was one of, you know, finding out what it was originally that made me even interested in this gesture, and then building out from that. And then in the process, it's a lot of, oftentimes I'm in a sort of creative place where I'm making a lot more mistakes than I am, you know, right decisions. So there's a lot of, you know, painting out, painting back in, you know, shifting. So
when you paint out, does that mean you actually remove the paint or do you just paint over? If somebody were to X-ray some of your paintings, would they find other figures in there?
They would find other worlds on there. Yeah. Yeah. There, yeah. No, it's just about painting out, over something. And I've had some paintings begin to reveal some stuff that was, you know, the pentimenti already presenting itself. And I had started a painting of a very large painting of a person in a chicken outfit with a big paper mache chicken head. I think I got the photograph from some weird state fair or carnival or something like that. And so I painted this big chicken on this thing and then realized I didn't have anywhere to go with it. I didn't know what it was. So I painted over it and ended up painting a portrait of a like a family portrait, but it was all fictional. They didn't actually know each other. I just took this guy from here, this woman from here, this kid from there, blah, blah, blah. And that painting went out into the world. I liked the painting a lot. It went out into the world. And a few years later, I get a call from my dealer saying, the gentleman who bought the painting says he thinks he sees a big chicken in it. Is that possible? I'm like, oh, God.
You go seek help.
Yeah.
You could really mess with some people's minds.
So. Right. Yeah. No, there's nothing there.
Oh. You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. And tonight my guest is artist Eric Fischel. He's a painter, printmaker, educator, and the author of a book called Bad Boy, My Life on and Off the Canvas.
You alluded to this earlier when we were talking about how an artist feels when his work is at auction. And I want to talk a little bit about the value of painting, because I think that's something that other people are interested in, but I also think it's probably something that interests you as a painter. I mean, is $1 million painting inherently better than a $250 painting?
The simple answer is no. I mean, actually it should be the flat answer, but I know you want to have a conversation around how much the market controls taste and sensibility.
And how did it feel to you when you did sell paintings, I'm sure, at some point for $250. Maybe that might have been a really great day to sell a painting for
$250. Yeah, yeah. And, yeah, no, those were early on, but they were welcomed and whatever for, you know, several reasons. One, it was money. Two, it was some kind of verification of something, some sense that somebody's willing to pay X amount of dollars for something that you've done. So,
and not as an investment. They liked the painting and wanted to hang.
Well, these were before there was a clear connection between the speculative market. When I started out, both as a in school, and certainly after until the mid 80s, fame and fortune didn't have a relationship to each other. So you could be like I was, ambitious to be famous, which is to say, I wanted to become part of a cultural dialogue, a historical dialogue, a marker in time and a reference, et cetera, those kind of things, right? We all knew at that time that that might happen, but that doesn't mean you're still not going to have to renovate other people's apartments or lofts, or you're going to drive a cab, or you're going to take a teaching job or do something that is the pragmatic aspect of, getting through a day.
Right.
And so those were the ambitions were very different, but then, starting in the 80s, a lot of things happened, none of which we were controlling or particularly aware of in terms of long-term ramifications. But I think you have to appreciate this particular moment in history and in contemporary history, which is up until the sort of late 70s, New York was the center of the art world, and it was very controlling of how to maintain that position. It was determining what works were of art represented that idea of who New York was. And even though it was international, it was highly selective as to what international artists were allowed to be a part of that scene. And it was controlled by a handful of galleries. It was controlled by a handful of critics, a handful of museums, a handful of publications. And in some cases, a handful was two or three. I mean, it wasn't even the whole hand, right? and then things started to happen, which is that the money market began to change. It began to become an international money market, not a Wall Street money market. So finances began to have a different relationship to place. Air travel became faster and cheaper, so people could travel more easily. And so that the exposure to a broader range of artistic expression based on where in the world they were became part of it. And then there was something which probably was even more significant, which was that the art world began to become hyper aware of how exclusive it had been. And the marginalized creatives, women, blacks, Hispanic, foreigners, gay, you know, et cetera, all of a sudden we're saying we have a right to be part of this broad conversation. And because they had been marginalized for a long time, a lot of the way they worked was alternatively, like women couldn't really break into the painting world. It was controlled, dominated by white males. So they went towards photography and towards other forms of genre media, et cetera, et cetera. You could see that throughout. So pluralism enters the picture as a force. And galleries realize they have to address this. All of a sudden, young galleries are popping up like crazy, proliferating, you know, scooping up young artists that no longer does a gallery represent a stable of artists that all do similar kinds of work. Now it's like galleries are showing everything, right? And critics they're forced to deal with such a broad range of material that scholarship goes out the window. It's a very fast-paced thing that's happening, an acceleration, and all of a sudden the extended articles get reduced to blurbs. They get reduced to short pieces that basically acknowledge that this show's happening now and this show's happening now. And they end up, because art magazines are 6 months out, galleries or museums are 2 years out. You know, curators working on shows, by the time they put up that show they worked on for 2 years, the art has changed, right? And so all of a sudden, there's this ramping up of speed as a way of dealing with this fact that the art world is now overwhelmed by not just the pluralism of diversity, but also three generations of European artists that have been slammed up against a door, stacked up, now spilled in. So all of a sudden, we're discovering fabulous artists that have been working for, you know, 40 years that we didn't even know about, you know, kind of thing. So art moves to dailies. It moves to weeklies and dailies. And part of that, when it goes to the dailies, is it goes to the same place that celebrities, movie stars, rock stars go to. So all of a sudden, art becomes this idea that you're an art star, right? You're now seen in the context of that. And that had a huge impact moving forward in terms of lifestyles and sort of attitudes. And anyway, I'm telling you all this in looking in hindsight, because in the moment we had no idea what was going on. And
was there like an awakening where you suddenly went, oh wow, you know, or was it a gradual thing?
Well, you know, when you're a young artist and you're excited about the vibrancy of the moment and the place you're in, that New York was like boiling with both, you know, creative expression and hyper competitiveness and fun, right?
Yeah.
And fun was a big factor as a part of it, because it was like the only way to deal with that pressure was to feel you're on some wild merry-go-round or, you know, something that you have to see part of it as amusing. So when your gallery is saying, I'm coming to pick you up in a limousine, you go, okay, that sounds like fun. Why not? You know, or when they say, we're going to take over a fancy restaurant, you know, okay, that sounds fun. You know, it's that kind of thing where for us, it just seemed like this is wild. This is weird. Let's try it. You know, what does $1,000 bottle of wine taste like? You know, anyway.
But, and does it then come to the point where is my limousine?
Yeah. Yeah. My career's over. I can't believe it. I've been waiting outside for 2 shows for a limousine and they haven't shown up.
Well,
it wasn't something that I pursued, and it wasn't something that I stayed with in terms of markers for me. But it was something that, you know, artists, younger artists coming into that, seeing that, it becomes a little bit harder to dismiss as just simply silliness, you know. Now it becomes a marker. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, part of that was also driven by the fact that the speculative market figured out a way to commodify art at scale, and you know, all of a sudden, you know, prices were just going insane.
So when you were thinking it in your early years that you wanted to be part of this history, that you wanted to be part of this thing, you weren't thinking, I want to be a shield against inflation for some collectors. That wasn't what it was
part that of. Yeah, somehow that wasn't a part of. Well, I've thought a lot about all of this stuff, because it, you know, as I said, first of all, we didn't know that we were actually the door that opened to allow this to happen, because we were actually approaching art as a radical constant radical reconfiguration of the past as a way of, you know, reinterpreting, reconfiguring, et cetera. You know, I went to New York like my peers did, to both embrace the dynamism of this art center called New York and the scale of it, and at the same time to destroy what had come before, right? To annihilate that by doing work that deserved to be on top. That was the ambition of it. And I don't regret that as an ambition, even though I recognize in my old age the absurdity of it. But I don't regret that, because it fuels a lot of creativity, a lot of decision making, that without that edge or without that scale, I wouldn't have, you know, push myself to it. And so there's that. But the you know, what happened by the 90s. It was very different. Can I tell a story as an example of how the world had changed in the art world?
Absolutely.
Can't remember whether it's in my book or not, but in the mid 80s, as a hot young artist, I was invited to Yale to give a talk. It was like 1985 or something like that. And so I go and I give my talk. And now the Q&A, and I, you know, point to somebody. And what followed was a feminist diatribe, followed by another and another and another, that absolutely annihilated me, absolutely wiped me off the face of the earth with, you know, feminist critique. It's like, whoa, that was pretty wounding. That was tough stuff. And then surprisingly, a few years later, I get invited back. And I had sort of been trying to reshape my way of responding to that critique. And I thought, you know, I think I can handle it. So I went back and I gave my talk. The first question was a Marxist diatribe. Against everything that I said, followed by another and another. I mean, just absolutely scarred me mercilessly with my, you know, bourgeois this and that. And so I left, and I thought, okay, that's it. I'm never coming back to Yale, man. That's just, you know, absolutely horrible. And 10 years passes. And I get invited back, and, you know, I'm now a mature artist, and I'm thinking, you know, how can they hurt me, you know? So I go back and I give my talk, and the first question was, who pays for framing?
Gallery or the painter?
Exactly. Yeah. Do you have a contract with your dealer? Etc. All they wanted to know were the business side of the art world. So when you want to sort of, you know, graph the change, that's it right there. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you're sort of talking about being old, but you're not as old as you're going to be. You're older than you've ever been, but not as old as you're going to be.
And of course, one hopes, yeah.
Painters certainly can paint long into their old age.
Wayne Thiebaud, he was died at 101, still painting.
So doing some incredible painting, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you think people will look at your work in 50 years or 100 years?
How do you think people will look in 150 years? Yeah. I don't know. I know the question you're asking. It's a funny thing to say that on one hand I'm painting to be in the moment I'm in, and then I'm hoping that it connects to something that has a kind of archetypal or something that a deeper level of authenticity and that carries it into another time with relevance, either charting, you know, human behavior in a way that 100 years from now people can say, oh yeah, I can identify with this person or this moment or not. In terms of stylistic appreciation or dismissal, I have no idea whether they'll look and say, God, he was so primitive. You know, he was so lazy, or, you know, I don't know. I don't know whether he'd say, whether they would see it as fresh or not. But
I think they might say not enough of his work had giant chickens coming through.
they're going to find a whole lot more interesting things than a giant chicken underneath some of those paintings. I'll tell you.
Eric Fischel, I have a whole lot more to ask you, so maybe you would want to come back and have a conversation with me again in the future.
I'd love to. I hope I didn't take up too much of my time.
Let me just mention the title of your book in case people want to read it, and I hope they will. It's called Bad Boy, My Life on and Off the Canvas. Eric Fischel, thanks so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me. It's great to see you, Gary.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. And joining me now is From the Bookshelf contributor Lissa Warren. She's a professor at Emerson College in Boston. She's the founder and president of Lissa Warren PR, a company that specializes in book and author publicity. And she's active on the Twitter, @Lissa_Warren. Lissa, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Hello, Gary. Nice to be with you again.
So have you been reading any interesting books?
I have. So I was inspired sort of around April 22nd, which is Earth Day, to pick up a book called Solving the Climate Crisis, Frontline Reports from the Race to Save the Earth. It's by a guy named John Berger. He's a doctor, PhD, and it has an introduction by Senator Russ Feingold. It's published by Seven Stories Press. It came out in October of last year. So I was a little late to the party on this one. But I'm glad that I made it eventually. It is at once optimistic and critical, and it argues that there is a feasible way to save our environment. It illustrates the power of committed individuals and the necessity for collaborative government and private sector climate action. I feel like there's so much doom and gloom these days about the climate crisis, so much, you know, wringing of hands. And there are things that we can do, practical things. And he's not just talking about, you know, like, recycling or turning off the air conditioning and open the windows. It's much, much more than that. It's doing things like lobbying your school district to, when they need to buy more buses, buy non-gas guzzling buses, buy, you know, like energy powered, not by things that kill us all, buses, electric buses. It can be done. He plots out ways that we can do these changes without actually spending a ton of money. Even things like solar panels, he says there should be a bank where people, like a central national bank, where people could get loans and buy their solar panels. And that would help reduce all of the problems that we have. So I thought it was super practical and super empowering and super encouraging, critical of what we're doing now, but offering a way forward. So that was my Earth Day book.
It's good to know that there are reasonable things that people can do instead of those impossible asks like recycling and turning off our air conditioning. Okay, that sounds like a good book. And it's we'll just recap, Solving the Climate Crisis, Frontline Reports from the Race to Save the Earth by John J. Berger. Isn't it all a woke plot, this whole climate crisis thing?
It turns out it's real, Gary. I hate to break it to you, but it's totally real.
Who knew?
Who knew? You knew. I knew. A lot of people knew, but not everybody knew.
No, not everybody. Those with the red hats say it's all.
Yes. Yes. Those folks. Yes.
Let's get rid of all electric vehicles.
Yeah. Why do something good for us and our kids and grandkids? Yes.
Yeah. What about now, as we say? Well, that sounds good. Tell me more.
So there's this book that has totally revolutionized the way that I work. It's called Micro Skills, Small Actions, Big Impact. And it's by Dr. Adara Landry and Dr. Risa Lewis. They're both medical doctors, MDs. And it was published by HarperCollins this past April. The book is built on one core, easy-to-learn principle, the idea that every big goal or complicated task or healthy habit, and even what we think of as character traits, can be broken down into small learnable skills that can be practiced and incorporated in real time. And they're called micro skills, hence the title of the book. These two authors are busy emergency medicine physicians at the height of their career. And like for sanity's sake, they have had to put into place all of these, I wouldn't call them hacks, like they're smarter than hacks, but all of these practical things that people can do that will just change the way that they conduct themselves in business and will help them to get further ahead. You know, any field, medicine, any corporate, anything of any kind, as I said, it's helped me a lot in my work, public relations. So they have these super practical tips. Things like setting time limits that you spend in meetings. Like say, okay, I'm going to do 2 hours worth of meetings this week and slot them in. And when you've reached your 2 hours, stop scheduling them. And instead of doing a meeting that's an hour long, knock it down to 45 minutes. Instead of a half hour meeting, see if you can do it in 20. You just earned yourself some time. So those are just some of the practical things that I've gotten out of it. But my favorite one of all, my favorite micro skill, is establishing a compassionate email culture, which means you're not emailing people outside of business hours. Although, to be blunt, you can prepare an email to them if it's a good time for you, if you've just put the kids to bed and now it's convenient for you. Just schedule it so that it doesn't send until 9 a.m. the next morning. Be respectful of their time, which is a nice thing to do. But you know what else? They won't answer you outside of business hours in all likelihood because they'll be receiving the email at a sane business time of day. So it's sort of self-protective too. I got a ton of tips like that. I could name 20 more out of this book.
The scheduling is a good one. Have you been using the scheduling one yourself? Do you schedule?
Yes, I've been doing it like crazy. I spend like my evenings or some time on the weekends just like queuing up pitches for the media. And I arrange them to go out at 9 a.m. in whatever time zone the media person is. So I factor in like East Coast, Central, Mountain, West. And I've seen an uptick in the results that I've gotten because I was doing that horrible thing beforehand of emailing people like after hours, which is rude as all get out. I don't know what I was thinking. Anyway, it's better for me. It's better for them. It's good.
Are you scheduling your tweets as well?
No, I don't do that. I probably should. There are all these studies that have been done on like optimal tweeting times, but I can't go there. I can't get that into it.
Too much.
I don't like just Elon Musk, so I just don't really want to go. I don't want to spend my life tweeting. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking of buying a Twitter from him and changing it back to Twitter.
Yeah. With the, like, however many millions, billions of dollars you just kind of have sitting in the bank.
How much you got on you?
On me, probably like maybe a 20, a crumpled 20 in a jeans pocket that's been through the wash a couple of times.
You made me think of something when you talked about the shorter, you know, cutting down the time that you spend. In Duck Soup, the Congress says to President Groucho, the workers of Fredonia are demanding shorter hours. He says, very well, we'll give them shorter hours. We'll start by cutting their lunch hour to 20 minutes.
Oh, clever. Okay. Clever, not to be outdone.
Micro skills, small actions, big impact by, how do you say the name?
Adara Landry and Risa Lewis.
Are they both women? Adara, is that a...
They are. They are. Adara is a emergency medicine practitioner at Brigham and Women's Hospital here in Boston. And Risa, smart lady that she is, went to Brown University and studied a specialist in ultrasound, actually, I believe.
Wow. And they had time to write a book.
I don't know how they found it, but I'm sure that they micro-skilled a way to make it happen.
Oh, that's good. I don't know where they come up with these peculiar names, but.
I think they're pretty names. I like them.
I do too.
Adara, Risa.
I'm in the middle of reading a book that you sent me and I really love that's called Rebel Falls. You want to talk about it for a minute?
Oh my gosh, I would love to. It's by a guy named Tim Wendel. And he is a novelist, but he does nonfiction too. This is a novel and it is an historical novel, which of course means that he did a whole lot of research when he was writing this book. It takes us to the late summer of 1864 as the Civil War is raging on. Sherman is marching on Atlanta and the armies of Grant and Lee are battling across Virginia. And then in the North, war weariness has made Lincoln's bid for reelection seem really, really doubtful. And as the fate of the nation conceived in liberty hangs in the balance, Confederate agents started gathering in Niagara Falls to plan one last audacious maneuver to turn the tide of the conflict. Now, silly me, like with my public school education, I thought that all of the Civil War took place in the South. It so didn't. Like I said, this is based on a true story. The guy did his research. There were actually people who were up at Niagara Falls and plotting to bomb a ship in the Great Lakes. And they thought that that would make it so that nobody would reelect Lincoln. And they probably were right. If they had been successful, probably Lincoln would not have run re-election and ours would probably be a much different country today than it turned out to be. But this is a fictionalized account of a young woman who took it upon herself to to save the nation and make sure that the attempts to bomb this ship did not take place, did not happen. There's like kind of an abolitionist thread in the book that's really cool, and like a really well-empowered woman theme going on. My family's from upstate New York, like my mom's side of the family. So I love this region of the country. And I felt after reading this book, like I'd taken a trip to Niagara Falls. It was just a really cool book.
Yeah, she's a great character, and this thing calls out for miniseries. But by the way, I'm pretty sure that Gettysburg is in the north.
Well, yes, that's true, I suppose. But I never even think of it that way. I don't know why. I'm like, Antietam. You know, I don't know. I just, I think Southern. I think Southern. Anyway, it's a great book. He's a wonderful writer. He's a creative writing professor. Like, this is what the guy does for a living.
Yeah, he does a really good job. I'm really enjoying the book of, you know, like the settings, the riding on a train or, you know, riding down a pathway or a road. I mean, it's really good. I like it a lot.
How'd you feel he handled a female protagonist being a male?
She's so great because he kind of surprises you. I don't want to give too much away, but you don't even know she's a female until, oh, all of a sudden she's a female. It's really cool.
He's really, really good. He's a great writer. It does sort of unfold in that way.
Yeah, that's neat. We got time for one more if you have one.
Yeah, sure. I would love to give you another one. It's another one that I think you're maybe going to have on your show. I hope you do. It's called Cracking the Nazi Code.
Oh, yeah. That's Untold. Nice,
you know
there.
This one too, right?
Yeah, go ahead.
It's subtitled The Untold Story of Agent A-12 and the Solving of the Holocaust Code. It's by Pegasus Books, and the author is Jason Bell. Now, Jason Bell is not related to the subject of his book. The subject of his book is Dr. Winthrop Bell. Same last name, no relation. Dr. Winthrop Bell was a Harvard philosophy professor and a wealthy businessman. And as an MI6 spy, known as Secret Agent 12, A-12, in Berlin in 1919, he evaded gunfire and shook off pursuers to break open an emerging Nazi conspiracy. And his reports were really the first warnings of the Nazi plot for World War II. He, of course, made these plots known, like he did not keep it to himself. But for various reasons that Jason Bell explains in the book, his concerns, his fears, his warnings were not taken nearly as seriously as they needed to be. Had he been heard, we might have been able to prevent the Holocaust. That is Jason Bell's saying in this book. That's a pretty big claim, but boy, he backs it. So much really, really well-researched history. It's an amazing read. It unravels and it's a page turner. And I don't normally say that about history. Like history can be pretty plodding, like where you have to bribe yourself with a cup of tea in order to like finish the chapter, but not this one. Before you know it, the book is over and you're like, oh, I don't want it to be done yet. It was so good.
Well, good. Well, I'm looking forward to that one. That also sounds like it sounds like TV miniseries material.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it could be. It absolutely could be. I think it could be like, I don't know. It could be a documentary, but it could also be fictionalized. It's one of those.
Well, if you want to be like well-read like Lissa Warren, there's Micro Skills, Small Actions, Big Impact by Adira Landry and Risa Lewis. There's Solving the Climate Crisis, Frontline Reports from the Race to Save the Earth. Why would anybody want to do that? By John J. Berger, Cracking the Nazi Code, The Untold Story of Canada's Greatest Spy by Jason Bell, and Rebel Falls, a novel by Tim Wendell. All good stuff. Lissa Warren, thank you, as always, for being with us on From the Bookshelf. It's great to hear from you.
My pleasure.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next time. I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.